Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program actor Alan Arkin. He has a new memoir called An Improvised Life. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be here again.
So you told your father when you were 5 years old that you wanted to be an actor, and you have pursued your calling with an intense passion that you describe in this book. Can you tell us a little bit about what you did and what your experience was as a small child, knowing that you wanted to act and learning to act?
Well, New York, where when I grew up, was a melting pot, and there was every conceivable kind of person on the planet just walking in front of our door all the time. So I used to imitate everybody and everybody I saw, all ages, all nationalities, all any kind of. I loved disformities of any kind. If somebody had a limp, I was happy with that. If somebody couldn't see well, that would be fair game. So everything became fodder for my desire to be anything other than what I was.
So you were watching people in real life. You were also watching performances.
Yeah.
And I was thinking as I was reading it, what's the difference as a student learning from somebody's craft and learning from real life?
Well, when I was a kid, I didn't know it was a craft initially. I mean, I go to the movies and I think, well, it was true of me, and I think it's probably true of most kids. You think you're watching a reality. As I think about it, I think it was true of most adults, too, in those days. There was infinitely less media than there is now. And so when somebody went to a movie, it felt like an important event. It didn't feel like just a way to knock off a couple of hours from an otherwise boring afternoon or evening and just something to knock off on a list of 50 things you wanted to see. Every time I went to a movie, it was an event. I would remember and chew on the event for a long, long time. And it wasn't just true of me. I remember my grandfather, who was an opera fanatic. Sunday afternoon, you would sit by the wooden radio, it was about a foot and a half tall, with a speaker about an inch and a half in diameter, and that was when he listened to the opera. And it was an important event in the week. It wasn't just something to do to pass the time. And it got talked about and thought about, and he was moved by it. I don't think it's the case very much anymore. I think it takes a 2x4 to really move somebody now.
There's a kind of amusing but very interesting moment in the book where you are, I think, 8 years old, and a friend of your mother's comes over and is having some problem in her life, and she's crying and carrying on, and you're watching this and kind of thinking, that's not a very good performance.
Yeah, it's kind of an aberration. I mean, for an eight-year-old kid to be thinking those terms, it's kind of nuts. But it was the degree in which I had, I guess, removed myself and thought about all of life as something to be used as fodder for a performance sooner or later. But I think it's a failing of a lot of actors. I think a lot of actors think of life as just stuff to be used in their performances. I think writers do that. I think directors do that. I think it can be a serious addictive problem for people. It's a kind of glorious, it's a very high-level problem, but I think it's still an aberration.
And it's something that you had to, as an adult, kind of look at and do something about.
Yeah, I had to. A lot of people don't. A lot of people don't think of it as a problem. A lot of people think that it's the only way they can live their life. It's the best way to live their life. But for me, at one point, I realized that that I had a career and everything was going wonderfully in terms of the career. But the minute something happened that where the career stopped in the course of a day, if I had to deal with a waitress or a waiter or a human being that had nothing to do with the business, I was at a loss. I just couldn't function. And I was, I guess, wise enough to realize that there was something wrong with that. and that my life was not just dog food for my career, and that that something had to be done. And it became a long, slow transition to the point where now I look upon my work as a reflection of my life rather than the reason and meaning for my life.
How did you make that transition?
Well, it was very, very, very slow and a very, very long arc. It started with three people, in my late 20s, three people telling me in 1 week I needed a therapist. And by the third time, I said, well, maybe I do need a therapist. So I went just to see whether that was the case, and I ended up spending 5 years in therapy, and it was an exciting adventure for me because I realized there was something inside of me that was malleable and changeable, and as changeable and as exciting and interesting as whatever my career was presenting to me. And it became a long, long, slow process of an internal look that stays to this day and stays more exciting and more dangerous and more exciting than anything I've ever experienced.
We're talking to Alan Arkin. One of the things, and I read your book with such fascination because when I was a kid, I tried to act and was terrible at it and never made the school plays and things like that, and admired so much the people who were able to draw on that ability to become other people. And there's something you wrote in the book, which is when you were young, that you sensed that the entire range of emotions possessed by one human being was universal and available to everyone, to anyone. And you were like, you were tapping into that deep well that connects all people. And I guess that's an artistic gift that actors have, that fiction writers have?
Yeah, it may be a gift, but I think it can be developed by anybody. I don't think it's I don't think it's peculiar to... I have a problem with the word creative, too. It's something... I teach improvisation workshops when I have the time. And one of the things I believe strongly is that creativity is something that everybody has access to. But people... like to think that other people are creative, like you doing this. I wouldn't think you think of yourself as necessarily very creative, but I feel in the way you approach your work, it's an enormously creative endeavor. The way you approach it, creativity is an approach to a task. It's not the specific. It's not the nature of a specific task. People like to think, well, I can't write or I can't perform, so I'm not creative. A mother can be creative. Like I say, what's the least creative? I say sometimes in the workshop, what's the least creative thing you can think of? Well, I say washing dishes or sweeping a floor. Okay, think of Chaplin washing dishes or sweeping a floor. It becomes the most creative event you can possibly imagine. And what's the difference between you and me washing dishes and Chaplin doing dishes? You say, well, he's a genius. Well, what makes up the genius? The genius is not some random thing that takes place. A lot of it is the extraordinary amount of time and effort he puts into examining that task and saying, how can I make something exciting and interesting out of it? And if we approach any task on the planet, I think we can do that. And it's not limited to actors or writers or musicians. Some people come in with a dose of it intuitively and instinctively, but I think it can also be developed.
You married young, you had children, but you were constitutionally unable to hold down a conventional job even when you were unemployed. There's this one moment where you tried to do an office job and it was just impossible.
Couldn't do it.
But then you, at a certain point, joined Second City, which is at that time, and now very famous, just beginning. What was it like? Tell us about some of the things you learned there.
It wasn't as if I learned things so much from other people as we were given an opportunity to fail, which is not something that you can do anywhere on the planet anymore. You're not allowed to fail in anything. You become material for the garbage heap if you fail at something. Whereas at Second City in those days, the audience came knowing that 25, maybe 30% of what they saw every day was not going to work. We were improvising. It was playing. If they saw one thing that was terrible, the next thing might be great, might be something they remember 50 years later. And I do have people come up to me talking about Kate, and it doesn't happen very often, but occasionally somebody will come up to me and talk about an improvisation they saw at Second City almost 50 years ago and how meaningful it was to them. So it was a grab bag of great things and terrible things, but we were allowed to experiment and play and fail in front of an audience, which is an invaluable experience. Not only that, but we play sometimes 15, 20 characters on any given night. So the range of possibilities, we'd be doing pantomimes, we'd be doing operas, we'd be doing 15, 20-minute scenes, we'd be doing sketches, we'd be doing dances. There was no end to the possibilities that were allowed to us, and it just doesn't exist on the planet anymore. I don't even think it exists in Second City anymore.
Really?
Yeah. Well, the last time I saw the shows was about at the 40th anniversary. It was about 10 years ago. And it was a lot faster, a lot more like MTV. Get on, get off, loud music. And it just felt completely different from the incredibly tightly bonded a group of eight that we were when we started out. It was much more a university crowd used to come to see us, and a much more adventurous, exploratory spirit. But that was going on in the country then. It was Kennedy was president.
The 60s.
Yeah, it was the 60s. And Hutchins was the dean of the Chicago University, and he said to the kids, he said, take anything you want. He says, don't specialize. He says, you're all smart. He says, you'll end up on your feet. And so they had a lot of people come out of the University of Chicago that knew a lot about a lot of different things but weren't specialists in anything. And they all ended up at Second City because there was nowhere else to go. So it was a wonderfully experimental, open, improvisatory time in the country.
We're talking to Alan Arkin. You went with Second City to New York at a certain point, and there's a wonderful description in the book about what happened when Groucho Marx was in the audience.
Yeah, it was. We were pretty sophisticated by that time. We had our chops. We knew what we were doing. We had a We were right across the street from NYU, so we had a university crowd that liked us. And one night, Groucho Marx was in the audience, and we had a scene in which I played Khrushchev, Andrew Duncan played Kennedy, and I had a translator, because I wasn't up on politics, so my translator was, I was responsible for the gibberish, and my translator was responsible for turning it to something intelligible.
Like the gibberish was fake Russian-sounding sounds.
Right. And so we fielded questions from the audience, and most of the times they were serious questions based on the fact that the Khrushchev-Kennedy war was going on at that particular time. So people wanted to ask serious questions, to which we gave satirical and simultaneously coherent answers. So we started fielding questions from the audience, and Groucho Marx's hands goes up. And I was wearing like a cab driver's hat at the time for no reason that I understood, but I felt comfortable. So Groucho Marx's hand goes up, and he says, yes, Mr. Question. He says, yeah. He says, Mr. Khrushchev, he says, where'd you get that hat? So I answered in gibberish. The audience laughed, and I answered in gibberish, and Severin translated. I think he said Bloomingdale's. And hand went up again. His hand kept going up over and over and over again. It kept asking questions about the hat. It never stopped. How much did a hat like that cost? He said, would they have one of my size? He says, is Bloomingdale's open after the show? Would it come in a solid color instead of the plaid? You've got just on and on, and to the point where the audience was hysterical. And we got hysterical. We just finally had to run off the stage. We had to just call it quits.
So Groucho essentially upstaged you guys.
Yeah, but we didn't mind at all. During the body of the show, he was wonderful. He was just part of the audience. But when it came time to ask questions, boom, there he was. He came back afterwards, and we spent, I guess, an hour and a half with him talking after the place closed down. And he was a god to us because he was the first improviser that any of us had ever heard of and knew about, and also an iconoclast, which we thought of ourselves as. And he ended up becoming a good friend of mine, which I'm very, very proud of. He was a terrific guy. One of the few people in the business that asked questions. He was very inquisitive about everything that was going on around him, which was a really lovely quality. Yeah.
One of the things that I thought was interesting that you write about in the book is that when you are directing actors, if they've been trained in improvisation, they're a lot easier to direct.
Yeah. Improvisational actors, particularly the kind of improvisational actors that come from the same kind of training I did, have a sense of the whole of the event. And most actors I know don't really pay much attention to the whole. They're concerned about their part and how they're doing, and that's about it. And a director has a lot of times to jam them into a sense of what the entire piece is about. There's a story about Peter Falk. I'm sure he wouldn't mind my telling it because it was kind of funny. After he got an opportunity to see The In-Laws when it first came out, before I did, he saw a rough cut of it. And I called him immediately after he saw it. I think I was out of town at the time. I said, what can you tell me about it? He says, well, he says, in my first scene, blah, blah, blah. He says, I'm pretty happy with that. He says, and as it went on, I'm doing that. And for about 15 minutes, he's telling me about his performance. And after about 15 minutes of listening to it, I said, what about me, Peter? Was I in the film? He says, I won't even notice that you're in the movie until I see it for about four times. And that's pretty much what actors are like, unfortunately. But Second City actors, I find, improvisational / Second City actors are not like that. They're concerned with the entity. And
well, they have to be because they're making it up as they go along.
Exactly. So they have to be aware of where they fit into what is taking place around them. So it saves an enormous amount of time for a director.
There's a beautiful part where you're talking about being in Second City and you're getting ready for a TV appearance and your improvisation partner has gotten very nervous and she stops listening. And as you're talking about, listening is the essence of improvisation. She's not listening anymore. You try everything. And then at the very last minute, there's one thing and only one thing that works, which is that you give her your everything she does. Even if she's not listening, you give her your love and it starts to work.
Yeah, I don't know where the idea came from. I mean, I wasn't interested in philosophy. The idea of love was not something that came into my vocabulary very much in those days. But it was a last resort. I didn't know what else to do. I tried everything in the world to get her to pay attention to the scene, and she was too fried to allow that to happen. And just as a last resort, I said, well, I'm going to love her. I'm just going to love her and see what happens. And the whole scene came back. She calmed down. I got my character back. I stopped being anxious and angry and about her, what I felt she wasn't doing, and the whole thing worked again. And it was a lesson I didn't learn in life until a long time afterwards, but it worked very, very well in that scene at that time.
It reminded me of that very last scene in the book A Wrinkle in Time, where the girl is trying to save her younger brother from the monstrous energy, and she hates it and she fights it, and then she remembers that she loves her younger brother and she pours out love and they're saved.
It's an incredibly profound and wise lesson that everybody, and I don't know everybody, but a lot of people just poo-poo and think it's kind of sentimental and old-fashioned and too simplistic to pay attention to. But it works. It just truly works.
We're talking to Alan Arkin. You describe in your memoir, An Improvised Life, the process of being transformed by meditation and the actual physical experience of having your heart open. And I wondered, I mean, sort of in the context of this issue of love, how did that or did it transform the way that you approached the art and craft of acting?
Oh, God, that's a long, it'll take me 20 minutes to begin to understand. A technique that I found intuitively, that there was a wonderful acting teacher called Michael Chekhov, I get in the 20s and 30s and 40s. He was also a very good actor. He's in a lot of movies in that period. And he talked about using, focusing on a different part of your body in order to find a different way of playing a character. Like if you think of yourself as living in your stomach, if you think of yourself as that being the core of where you live, it's going to affect the way your emotional life expresses itself. It's also going to affect the way you look as you start walking around. You think of yourself as that being your stomach, as your stomach being your center. It's going to affect the way you walk, the way you sit down. Same thing, if your center is in your butt, it's going to do that. If your center is in your heart, it's going to affect, again, the way you walk, the way you look, the way you talk. And I felt for many, many years, I understood that intuitively. Like the characters I played lived in different parts of themselves. And I felt like I had a kind of a fluid way of accessing those different parts of myself. And then when I had this experience after meditating for about 3 or 4 years of my heart exploding open, all of a sudden I was faced with a sense that I lived there, that my center was in my heart no matter what I did. There was no way of getting around that was where I lived. So it changed the way I had to think of my technique. Which is, again, something I intuitively understood, that my technique had to change in order to accommodate my growth as a person. A lot of people don't do that. I see a lot of people in the arts stultifying their own growth as a person because it won't accommodate the success they found. The success they found came with a certain mindset, soul set, emotional set of values, and they hang on to that because they don't want to change. They don't want to change themselves, so they force themselves to stay in that same mode, and it doesn't work. It can't work. Like I think a lot of times, writers. I don't know if I talk about this in the book, but to me, I don't think there is such a thing as writer's block. I don't think that that's a simplistic way of looking at it. That to me, writer's block happens when somebody goes through a metamorphosis, and their technique has not caught up with the emotional change that they've made as a person. It requires an examination of who you have become, and then letting your writing catch up with that, rather than thinking of yourself, bam, as a closed circuit. I am a writer.
And this kind of writer,
this kind of artist. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, your book is called An Improvised Life, and that's part of the improvisation is going through these metamorphoses and letting them affect you on every level.
Yeah, exactly. And it becomes an exciting adventure. I mean, I at one point I wanted to call my book Tap Dancing on a Rubber Raft, which I feel is what a really good life is all about. It's like learning how to be on the rubber raft, which is our existence, and being the best tap dancer you know how to do. Whoops, it's tilting to the left. Like, how can I accommodate that? Well, it's tilting to the right. And it's where we all live, but most people don't want to acknowledge it.
Yeah, most people are looking for that solid floor beneath their feet.
It ain't there. It's just not there. And we're living in a time right now where more and more people are recognizing that. And I think a lot of people are freaking out because they haven't accommodated that idea into their consciousness. And where I end up these days is And it's the happiest I've ever been. And it's as a result of thinking this way, is that I haven't got a clue. Nobody's got a clue what the next moment is going to. I haven't got a clue, but it's fine. If I live this moment as meticulously as I know how to do it, the next moment will be what it has to be, whatever it needs to be. So that's become pretty much my focus these days. Just, I want to live this moment as well as I possibly can, to the best of my ability.
There's a wonderful moment in the book where you talk about yet another transition of going from a place where acting is laborious and difficult and work to enjoying it. And there's a film, I can't remember which film it was, but hundreds of people who saw it came up to you afterwards and said, you look like you were having fun.
Yeah,
and it was the first time that ever happened.
Yeah, it was the in-laws.
Okay,
yeah,
that's right.
It was the first time. Well, I was earning all this money, and I spent all this time and energy learning a craft, which was incredibly hard for me. Some people find it very easy, but for me, it was very, very difficult. I guess, which is part of why I can talk about it. I can talk about it because it was so hard, I had to intellectualize in order to give myself a technique to arm myself against how afraid I was of going on stage. But all of a sudden, I'm doing the in-laws, and I'm having a good time. And it felt illegal. It felt like I was going to get caught and fired. And it took some time in order to get used to the fact that it was okay, that it was an okay place to be.
Is it where, I mean, from where you were then and then afterwards, did it stick? I mean, from then on, could you just enjoy your work?
Yeah, I can enjoy it now if I'm with people who are enjoying it. If I'm working with people who are like I used to be, whose lives are at stake, who feel like they're curing cancer, who feel like this movie is going to be the greatest thing that ever hit the universe or else, then it's enormously painful because I feel like I'm absorbing their anxiety and their pain, and it's hard. It's painful. But if I'm with people who have a twinkle in their eye, who realize that it's valuable and important to have a good time, that it's not trivial. Having a good time is not necessarily trivial. Having fun may be trivial, but being joyous about something is not trivial. There's a big distinction between the two. And I think that not only is it much easier and as creative, maybe even more creative, but I think it has a valuable statement for the audience. I think the audience needs to know that people in the arts are having a wonderful time doing what they're doing. And I think the tortured artist serves anything particularly. You may end up with a pretty good piece of work, but the torture is somewhere in it as well. And I don't think the torture, I don't know what it serves after a while.
Well,
what the torture served me was to get me to a point where I'm out of it, where I'm not in that place anymore.
There's I didn't write it down, but there's a place in the book where you talk about the importance of the joy and the generosity that you have as an artist that you are giving to others, and I think there's something about, for lack of a better word, the energy of that joy and generosity that naturally finds a home in the people who are watching your performance.
I don't remember that part.
In other words, they feel it. The people who are watching that feel it. And there's this very interesting, I mean, the beginning of the book, there's all of this, there's a lot of places where you make analytical comparisons between two different things that you saw that seemed superficially similar but had very opposite effects. And one of them was, you saw a film with a star who had supposedly given a wonderful performance and it left you depressed. And then you saw another film not too long after with a wonderful performance that left you uplifted and full of the sense of possibility.
Yeah.
And you spend quite a bit of time in your head afterwards saying, what was the difference between those two?
Yeah. Yeah, the first one was won the Actor an Academy Award. He had done it on Broadway and then did it as a film. and he got an enormous amount of attention for it, an Academy Award. And I came out of the theater feeling depressed and angry and jealous. And I said, what a... And I hated myself for feeling that way. So I'm watching a great piece of work, and I'm just jealous about it. What's wrong with me? And about 2 weeks later, I saw Walter Huston in a movie called The Devil and Daniel Webster. And I came out of the theater elated, walking on air as a result of having seen his performance. And I said, wait a minute. Maybe it's not me. Maybe I'm not just such a terrible person. Maybe there's a difference in what I'm receiving from one performance and the other that it's creating this in me. And I thought about it and thought about it. I finally realized after, I think I went back to see the first performance a couple of times again. I realized that he was not giving me anything. It was an ego demonstration. It was a demonstration of how well he walked, how beautiful his voice was, how well he understood the text. That was the first performance, and my role there was to admire him and say how wonderful an actor he was, whereas Walter Huston in The Devil and Daniel Webster was giving me the present of a joyful exploration of an entire human being. He presented a whole human being in front of me, and it was filled with excitement and invention and joy, the joy of performing, the joy of exploring the character, and his absorption and of the character and his complete absorption of the character and the joy he expressed was my gift. The first guy was not giving me a gift at all. He was looking for admiration, and I said, that's the kind of actor I wanted. I want to be like Walter Huston.
We're talking to Alan Arkin. The book, your book, An Improvised Life, really reads like the... sounds too spiritual, but like the journey of a truth seeker. And
how dare you?
You know what I mean? But, and I guess the thing, I mean, at the beginning when you're a kid, you're talking about learning to act and basically trying to be anyone but yourself, and then learning to kind of find yourself, or realizing that getting in touch with yourself again, for lack of a better word, is something worth doing. And did that make your acting better when you became more of an introspective person?
That's a tough question. It depends on what you mean by better. I mean, what I don't know what value system better or my, I think that there was such a desperate necessity to be an actor for so long that there was a kind of laser beam intensity that my work had early on that was interesting to watch. I don't think that's there anymore, but I think what's taken its place is a kind of a wisdom about myself that, I mean, I used to think that if a take didn't work, I had to hide in the corner, and I couldn't face anybody. If every single take, every time I went in front of the camera didn't work, I was miserable, and it was exhausting. But I think that kind of thing, it's aberrated, but aberration is interesting to look at. Some of our greatest stars are deeply aberrated people, but that's what that's what is interesting to look at. If you see a realized person, a person who knows themselves and enjoys themselves in front of the camera, it's nice, but it's not as riveting as somebody who is on the edge. I mean, if you go into a room and there are 10 people in the room, and 9 of them are very healthy, well-adjusted people, and one is a raving lunatic, who are you going to look at? You're going to look at the unresolved person. I think there's a necessity in all of us, mostly unrecognized, for resolution. We want to be resolved. I think most of us realize that one way or another, we're not resolved. We're not happy. We're not healthy. We're scared about tomorrow. And we look We look for resolution, but the way we look for it, for particularly in films, we look at the unresolved people on the screen who are like us, and then hope by the end of the movie that they're going to get resolved. So that it's like what T.S. Eliot said, that great quote of T.S. Eliot's. He says, there is only one drama. He says, it's man's fall from grace and his redemption. And every movie is not as exalted a version of that as T.S. Eliot is talking about, but that's what every movie is about. The stupidest comedy is, oh, I lost my socks. If I don't get my socks, my wife is going to kill me, blah, blah, blah. And it's a very minimal view of that same T.S. Eliot thing. That's the way this guy's going to get redemption, by finding his socks. It's stupid and small, but we laugh at it because of how small it is. Recognizing in our subconscious that what is at stake is really much more than what this idiot is putting himself through because of his socks. But if you see a person who's resolved in the beginning emotionally, it's not going to be as interesting as seeing somebody like, for better or for worse, who's the guy that... The beaver.
Mel Gibson.
Yeah, I mean, like Mel Gibson. You look at him. You know. You didn't need to hear his outburst on. You didn't need to hear his outburst against the police in L.A. You need to know about his drunken escapades. But you look at him. If you look carefully at the behavior going on from movie to movie, you know that there's something not working. And that's what people, that's one of the things that people like about watching, aside from the fact that he's a good-looking guy, blah, 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 blah. But it happens over and over and over again.
Do you think that keeps actors, in other words, who want to stay on that edge, who want to stay unresolved, keeps them from becoming whole, well-adjusted
yeah,
human beings?
I do. Yeah, I do, and it's sad. I mean, it was one of my dearest friends is in the business. He's a wonderful guy. Is Andy Garcia? He's a lovely, lovely person, and he's as generous and kind and open as anybody I've ever met in the business. But we're talking about this kind of thing. He said, "Boy, I'm not going to let go of my dark side." He said, "Because half the parts I play are going to be, they'll go out the window." So here's this really very special guy, who is harboring a place in himself that he ain't going to give up because it may affect his livelihood, and it's understandable. But there's also a tragic. Aspect to it. I remember there was a moment, one of the pivotal moments in my life. I don't want to go into too deeply, but one of the pivotal moments in my life was a film I did with Jimmy Kahn years and years ago, in which he and I were instrumental in helping the script work. We spent weeks ahead of time with the writer making the script work because it didn't work. So I felt like I had more of an investment in it than I would ordinarily have. We get in the middle of the film, and the director has decided that morning he's going to change the script and do something that I felt to be disgusting. And this was after having a lot of fights with the director as we went along, because I felt his taste was abominable. And I was so upset at this point that I found myself saying to him, I said, "You can put this in the movie when I'm not on the set or I don't hear about it. But if this goes in the film, again, this is something that Jimmy and I had rewritten, spent weeks and weeks rewriting. If this goes in the film and I hear about it, I said, I'm walking off the film. I'm not going to sit in my trailer. I'm going home and I don't care if I ever work again." And it was a pivotal moment in my career and my life, because I finally realized that there was something more important to me than career. You know, it's one of those wonderful moments where I felt, if I don't act, if I don't get a job, I'm going to die, blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden I said, well, I don't care. I don't care. There are more important things than this aspect of my life. And I found it was a great moment because I found out what that was.
We're talking to Alan Arkin. There's a wonderful passage in the book about your experience of a concert at Carnegie Hall, and I urge people to get a copy of this book by calling 428-1393, the KSFR fund drive, and you can get a copy of this book for a donation to KSFR. It's a very important and interesting passage. It's too long to read right now, unfortunately, but maybe you could read. Could you read from the introduction to your book?
Sure.
An Improvised Life, a memoir by Alan Arkin.
Yeah, this was a moment with Madeleine Kahn, who I was a great fan of. We at one point made a movie together, and this is the prologue of the book. Some years ago, I did a film with Madeleine Kahn. A lot of it was shot on location, and one day we found ourselves at a particularly beautiful spot overlooking a panoramic view of the Hudson Valley. During a lull in the shooting, while the cameras were setting up, we went out onto an extensive lawn and sat there for a while, lost in the scenery. While we were musing and chatting, I found myself thinking about Madeleine's many gifts. She was a fine actress, an excellent pianist. She had an exquisite operatic voice with impeccable technique, and she was also a brilliant comedian. I asked her which of her talents she considered to be her primary focus. She thought for a while and couldn't come up with an answer. I don't think she'd ever thought about that before. "Well, what did you start out wanting to do?" I asked. "What was your first impulse? Was it acting?" She shook her head. "No," but she didn't seem sure. "Singing?" "No." "Playing the piano?" "No." "Did you want to be a comedian?" "No, not really." "Well, what was the first thing you thought of doing? There had to be something." Again, she tried to thread her way back to her childhood ambitions. "Well, I used to listen to a lot of music." She paused, trying to find the words for what she was thinking. "And that's what I wanted to be," she finally said. "I don't know what you mean," I said. She answered, and it sounded as if she'd never formulated this thought before, as if it was news to herself. "I wanted to be the music," she said. It was a revelatory and somewhat disturbing moment. With that one statement, I realized that what she'd said about herself was the impulse behind all of my own interests, all of my needs, all of my studying, compulsions, and passions. And had I been aware of that idea when I was starting out, had I been able to assimilate it, live within it, I would have saved endless years of frustration and work and confusion, because that thought was at the very bottom of what I was looking for. So much had been invested in craft, in externalization, in looking for something solid out there that would fill the void, create a sense of flight, of getting out of the oppression of self. We don't want to do it, we want to be it. Only we don't know that. No one tells us. This book is dedicated to everyone and anyone who wants to be the music.
Alan Arkin, that's a beautiful passage. And there's so many different parts of the book that one thinks of that passage when you're reading it. There's this one moment where you're talking about auditioning actors, and they do their part, and then you say, "Okay, now do it without the acting."
Yeah, yeah. That's happened every time I've directed a play, and not once, but it must have happened at least 100 times over the years. And there's not been one occasion in which the actor didn't know exactly what I was talking about. And like a light will go on in their eyes, and they won't say this, but I see in their face this, what they're saying is, "Oh, you mean you want me to do what I trained for, what I studied for, what I started out wanting to be, instead of selling it, instead of selling the performance, you want me to just do it?" And they do it a second time, and they will have relaxed, and they will have gone back at least 50-60% in the next reading to being true to what their goals were, rather than a salesman.
Right, and that thing, I mean, there's that, like, this idea that in our society we're always having to sell and getting outside of that. And it sort of reminds me of the other part, where we're always having to succeed, and how at Second City, when you do improv, you get to fail. You get to fail. You get to stop selling. You get to play. And that's where the reality is.
Yeah. That's where, not just the reality, but where peace, where you get some degree of peace in your life. we're not perfect. I mean, allowing ourselves to take chances and play is crucial, I think, to being happy. A lot of people come to the workshops I teach because they've lost that sense of play in what they do. I don't think it's conscious a lot of times. I don't just get actors. I'm happiest when the group consists of, like, teachers and psychologists. We'll get musicians, writers, all different kinds of people. And I love the mixture much more than just working with actors. And invariably, when I ask, I start out by asking why they came. What do they want to get out of it? A lot of it is to regain that sense of play. Just like with kids with dyslexia, there's a technique. I don't know if they still use it for a long time. Kids with dyslexia were retaught how to crawl. That they learned how to crawl the wrong way. They would crawl with the left arm and the left leg, and then the right arm and the left leg, and the right way to do it is opposing limbs. And in learning how to do that, they regain the sense of some of the dyslexia tends to go away, is my understanding. But in play, it's like we think of play as something that kids do before they get serious with something. I firmly believe, I haven't read a lot of psychology about this, but I'm sure it'll be borne out by some of the best psychologists, is that play is crucial. When you look at kittens and I think I talk about this in the book a little bit, you see kittens and puppies doing what we call, in quotes, playing. They're learning the tools for how to become adults. They're learning crucial tools for how to become adults. And I think kids do the same thing. And I think kids can learn how to play wrong sometimes. Like the images they have, if they're using images of adults when they're playing, sometimes it can be the wrong images. It can disturb them when they become adults.
Or they're just watching screens instead of moving stuff around with their hands and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
It's the last section of the book. You describe some of these improvisation workshops that you teach, and one of the things that's really beautiful about it to me is that spontaneously from non-actors comes some of the most poetic, beautiful, true, and interesting performance where you least expected it.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, the core of the book, I didn't start out wanting to write this. It pretty much happened. I didn't sit down and decide to write my memoirs. I didn't have that grandiose vision. But there was an event that happened at the IAIA in town here that was so unbelievably moving with a bunch of kids, young Native American kids who were studying there. None of them were actors. They just wanted to take the workshop for a couple of days. And what came out of it was so unbelievably moving that I just felt that I had to write it down so I remembered it as closely the way it happened as I possibly could. And then I found other things in other workshops were occurring that were almost as moving as that, and I wanted to have records of that. And that, the record of that started becoming the core of the book, and I just started spiraling around that and ended up with whatever this is.
The book is called An Improvised Life by Alan Arkin. Before we go, would you say maybe a word or two about why people should call right now and make a contribution to KSFR by calling 428-1393?
Well, my God, this program and the rest of the station is one of the few, I think, independent places to listen to facts unenhanced or inhibited by politics, and it's crucial to keep that venue open. It's our station, it's our city, and it's very important.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte. It's nice to talk to you again, and you really read the book. I'm astounded.
It's a wonderful book. Everybody should read it who has any interest at all in any of the subjects that we've covered today. So thank you.
Nice to see you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.